Skyline's new chicken chili is here. Now you can enjoy that legendary Skyline taste with a new protein option. Try Skyline's chicken chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. Feeling good. It's Skyline time.
Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its fucking house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today is actually November 3rd here in the United States. I mean, it's November 3rd everywhere, but it is stressful. It's a stressful day. It's a real stressful day because today is Election Day here in the United States. If you are listening to this on the day of, I highly, highly, highly encourage you to vote. If you haven't already voted, please, please, please do so. There are a lot of people, myself included, who have a very vested, very personal stake, in this election and, what it means if the outcome goes one way or the other. So, I do encourage you to please vote. And please vote with the least among us in mind. Don't just vote for your own interests, for your own privilege, but vote for those who don't have a voice. Vote for those who don't have privilege. I know it's a real stressful day for a lot of people. So I thought that it would be a fun time to have a conversation with Jess Mason. Jess Mason is a pop culture journalist for the Mary Sue and the hostess of the new podcast, The Real Magic Podcast, which is a really, really fun podcast where she talks about sort of the intersection of paganism and real witchcraft with the witchcraft and magic that you see on screen. I actually had the privilege of being on her show. She asked what movie I wanted to talk about, and I wanted to make sure that I got to get in there and talk about practical magic before anyone else had the chance to talk about my favorite movie of all time. So you can go download her show, The Real Magic Podcast, and listen to my interview with her. But now, don't do it right now, because we're about to listen to an interview on this show. So you got to listen to this show first and then go listen to that one. I do want to remind you that Patreon supporters heard this episode first. If you would like to support independent pagan media, you can give as little as $1 a month and you get early access to full unedited audio content. For a few dollars more a month, you can get full unedited, full video content as well. And you can find all that at patreon.com/incitingprojects. Now, just sit back, unwind, drink all the wine that you have, all the coping mechanisms that you purchased for today, and enjoy a little brain break with this interview with Jess Mason. Jess Mason, welcome to Inciting a Riot. How are you, my dear?
I'm doing good. Like, it's a good for the apocalypse, you know? Got my coffee and we're going to make it through somehow. A little optimism and witchcraft will make it through.
I have to say congratulations on the new podcast.
Thank you so much.
For folks that don't know, you are a journalist, a pop culture writer. As you told me on Twitter, a genre writer. I can't wait to dig into that. That has sort of shifted now. You're branching out and you now are the hostess of the Real Magic Podcast.
Yeah, I've always been into pop culture and I've been a witch for most of my life. And so I finally wanted to talk about the way those two things intersect. And there's a lot of great pagan podcasts out there, but this is specifically like a movie and television podcast, but also pagan and looking at the way that witches and paganism are portrayed on screen, usually inaccurately, but, you know, but often in really fun movies. And so, you look at something like I just did an episode on Hocus Pocus, and not a terribly accurate portrayal of witches, sadly.
What? I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I know that every Halloween I'm looking for a virgin. So,
I mean, I shoot lightning out of my fingers too when I'm pissed off.
Clearly,
but like that movie is still so much fun and so entertaining, and it's such like dear thing to so many people. And so, just we talked about what makes it a great movie and what makes it so appealing, especially to witches. So it's digging into all those things, and we're going to talk about, like, we have episodes planned about the Craft and the New Craft remake. We're going to dig into that, see how that goes. Oh, I have hope it's going to be good, but
you know, I always worry with remakes, reboots, rehashings of things that are considered good sort of because of the camp quality of them.
Yeah.
I'm coming on your show to talk about Practical Magic.
Yeah.
And that's a show like that's a movie I just don't know that you could like do again.
Yeah, it's so of its time, and it's so like a lot of the things that make that movie good are, I don't know if they intended them.
Right. Oh, Practical Magic, but like a lot of those 90s witch, I mean, The Craft is a big one, and it's in the zeitgeist right now because the remake or reboot or it's a spiritual sequel. Like it's supposed to be in the same universe, but I'm like, it's in the same universe like 30 years later. Like it doesn't count. Come on.
Yeah. The one I'm really actually more worried about is this new version of The Witches with Anne Hathaway. Just because
but like it's Anne Hathaway and it's Octavia Spencer but
the thing that I don't like that I've seen the trailers is they're using all CGI, and the thing that made that movie great was the use of the practical effects and the practical makeup on Angelica Houston.
And I think that's what I'm kind of getting at is that some of those like more campy films I think really sit inside of the soul of a lot of witches because there wasn't a lot of CGI. There weren't really a lot of, it was either all practical effects or it was like tricks of the camera, tricks of the light. So it felt more like real magic. So it feels more relatable to people to see, you know, their magic portrayed on screen.
Yeah. And that's why like my least favorite thing about The Craft whatever.
It's
like
the sparkle fingers.
The sparkles. I'm like, is this
the
like an Instagram
sparkle fingers? I gotta tell you, man, I am really not thrilled about the sparkle fingers in the Craft remake. I'm like, the most CGI, like, fake witchy thing I can remember from the original movie is when they, like, fly.
Yeah, or when Sarah does her glamour and turns her...
Yeah, like... but that's so freaking subtle, man. Like, that was just... That was a little... Like, you could do that with an app now. Like, you know, a little bit of a change of the color of the hair. But so much of that was practical. I mean, it's you know, petals floating in a breeze. It's sharks on a beach, you know?
Yeah, it's like they literally filled a stage or soundstage with just a record number of reptiles and snakes and bugs. Like they broke a record initially set by Indiana Jones and Last Crusade.
All those snakes in that house at the end, it creeps me out.
The snakes don't bug me, all the bugs and like there's...
All of it. I don't want any of it. I don't want any of it, not a bit of it. So Miss Jess Mason, how did you become Jess Mason? How are you? how did you become a pop culture writer?
It's kind of weird because my training is as first an opera singer, then a lawyer, which are not terribly related. Shut up, Facebook. But I was a family law attorney in like 2012 or so. And I don't know if you've ever been involved with family law or the legal system, but it's terrible. And people are really mean and awful. And that was also...
I also worked in the juvenile court system as well. Yeah.
I worked in juvenile stuff. And then my Saturn return hit.
Earliest days of this podcast, I was still working in juvenile services.
It's a hard area to work in. It's like there's literally a lot of secondhand PTSD.
Oh, and it's rough. When you go home, you're not really home. Like it sits with you. The things that you see, the things that you do, stories you hear, the stuff you're involved with, it's rough.
And like, I worked in criminal law before too, and family law clients are so much bigger assholes than criminal clients, and they're assholes when it's involving their kids, and it's just and family law lawyers are just awful to you. So I took a break and stepped away, and I was in like having a lot of depression, and it was not a great time in my life. But I started watching Netflix and like, oh, what's this show with like, it's got at that point only 144 episodes. I hear people talking about it on Tumblr. And so I kind of just like fell into Supernatural as sort of my like coping mechanism. And there was so much interesting things to dig into with that show and good writing, like on Tumblr and everywhere, that I just started throwing myself into that and just looking at fandom as a like scholar. And as a fan, like, this is a fascinating world. So I started writing about it, and I started writing freelance for the Mary Sue and covering things like Comic-Con and that sort of thing. And so eventually I moved from freelance to a staff position, and now I'm there full time. But yeah, it was like directly related to Supernatural that I started like getting into fandom and then writing about fandom. And so, yeah, I have a lot to owe to that silly show with the hot underwear models that kill ghosts. You know?
So I'm glad to hear you say the silly show with the hot underwear models that kill ghosts, because like that show has had, it's had several lives, I think.
It has. It's on its fourth showrunner, and it's really had like so many distinct eras, and it's changed so much in 15 years. And that's one of the reasons I find it still fascinating, because it's gone through so many different iterations, and you know, the way its place in culture has changed and its place in fandom has changed, and the way we portray inclusivity and the way we tell stories has changed over the time that the show has been on air. And so it's been interesting to see how it's changed and how it hasn't.
It started off as one of those, you know, typical CW Supernatural dramas.
It was on the WB. It existed before the CW. Oh,
that's true. That's true. I mean, you know, which is a network that gave us Buffy. It gave us Charmed. I mean, it was sort of in that vein of, hey, we're the people that put sexy underwear models in supernatural positions and make them superheroes. Let's do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's make some guys some monster hunters. And it was supposed to be a five-year run. The original story was 5 years.
And then they're like, wait, 15.
It's 15 years. And I will tell you, I watched it. I loved it. I loved it for many years. And then, like Grey's Anatomy, like many other long-running shows that I started off and loved, I just couldn't stand it anymore. after several years, like I saw the 5-year run, I held out for several more years, and then just like eventually, somewhere about halfway through the run, I was like, okay, so they've beaten heaven, they've beaten hell, they've beaten purgatory, they've beaten all the monsters, the mermaids and the Wendigos and
leprechauns,
all of it. They've beaten all of it. And somehow they're still afraid of things, and things are still coming after them. And I'm like, you know, if you kill God or several gods, I feel like eventually stuff stops coming after you. Like, I feel like stuff eventually like gets the hint that like you're going to kill them. And so I was just like, now I realize that like talking about the seriousness of a plot line on Supernatural is inherently very is an absurd thing to do, but like at some point I'm just like, I just don't take it seriously anymore, which again, coming out of my mouth feels weird. It's a weird mouth feel, those words coming out.
There was some like tweet or Tumblr post where somebody's like, Supernatural's on, what were they gonna fight, like God's like creepy cousin Larry, and somebody responded like, oh yeah, that was season 9's plot, his name was Metatron.
Wait, really?
Well, like he wasn't his cousin, he was just like a disgruntled angel. And now it's like, I think it's really interesting though, in their final season, like the final boss is actually God himself, like the God the creator, and God as an literally as the author of their stories. And it's kind of some interesting stuff about like,
okay, but the author's been there before, right?
Yeah, he showed up in season 4, but he wasn't revealed as God until season 11.
Oh, so, except then, we all knew that he was
his
God.
Sister, you know, God has a sister. And she showed up in season 11 and had the hots for Dean, which you cannot blame her for. Because,
he's pretty. So let's talk fandom. Let's talk writing fandom. You got in some hot water, ma'am.
I didn't think I would. I'm so used to just like
you being in fandom. Hot water, ma'am. I am a lover of weird niche little shows, little supernatural shows. I will deep dive on an anime. I will, you know, you want to talk Full Metal Alchemist? Do you want to talk Sword Art Online? Do you want to talk, I mean, like My Hero Academia, though a lot of people like hate that because of how popular it's become. Like, you know, I will deep dive into some shows, and I get like how like the different kinds of ways that fans interact with those shows online. And you know, an example that a lot of people probably know are like Disney princes. There has been like this push in the last 10 years, like every now and then an artist will do like sexy Disney princes.
Oh yeah. I think I remember that.
Yep.
Tumblr
you'll
art.
Do some sexy Disney princes here or there. So people like, as we grow up and we get older and we get access to things like artistic skills and the internet, we take our the things that we love and the things that we grew up with, and we turn them into porn.
That's like the human experience is taking something and turning it into something for sex.
We do a lot of other things with stories, such as like shipping characters, which is where you kind of wish and hope that there are characters that like each other. You got in some hot water, man, because you suggested that the two aunts from Practical Magic are secretly a lesbian couple. How'd that go over with the internet?
Well, like some people were like, yes, totally, it's great. And then like a lot of people who maybe aren't really into fandom, we're like, well, the book says this. I'm like, well, I don't care what the book says. And like, this was specifically about the movie. And I was just saying like, well, you could watch this movie one way, because there's really actually nothing contradicting this specifically in the movie, because they never actually like call each other sisters in the movie, and I remember. Where I'm like, well, what if, because like usually it's two sisters in each generation, one with red hair, one with dark hair. And obviously Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman's mom had red hair, because you see her at the beginning of the movie. So that means there's this extra third sibling. That's where'd she come from? Obviously, she's Stalker Channing's wife. And because, you know, there's a lot of like crunchy granola lesbians out there at the solstice rituals. They met somewhere, and like, that's just a fun way to look at it. And everyone's like, you're promoting incest. You're just desecrating this beautiful thing. You're shitting on the book. I'm like, but I'm literally saying this is based on the movie, and I'm saying they're not sisters, that they're just wives. And they're still aunts. They're still both aunts. It's just one of them is an aunt by marriage.
So I knew what you were doing there, because I did the same thing growing up. Back when I was a kid and watching Power Rangers, I wanted to be Billy and marry Jason, clearly.
Yeah.
But, you know, growing up as a young gay kid in an area where, you know, that was a very bad thing to be, there's really not a lot of representation for you. And I don't think that a lot of people realize that for LGBTQ people, there's just really not a lot of representation on screen for us.
Yeah.
And even now that's gotten better, but it's still not widespread enough, and it really hasn't been around that long for us to really have that many characters, that many plots, that many movies, that many TV shows that are ours that we could sort of see ourselves in. So I kind of get it, because I also would find what are called queer-coded characters.
Yeah.
You know, stories, plots. I mean, Hades in Hercules is a big one for a lot of people. Hades is a big one. The Queen of Hearts and Alice in Wonderland is a big one. I mean, you know, there's
so many Disney, like the queer coding of Disney villains,
Scar,
is a whole big thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, childhood movies, TV shows, things like that, where, you know, the audience, especially queer kids, will try to say, "Are you? I can find a different interpretation of that that makes me feel seen on TV."
Yeah, it's like Xena and Gabrielle might be more than friends.
Okay, but I remember the interview with Lucy Lawless for the final season, and I don't remember the magazine that it was in, but I remember specifically that she said, "Yeah, they're wives. They're married.
Yeah, like
they're totally married."
I'm still actually mad about the final few seasons of Xena because I didn't.
Oh, I mean, well,
like,
yeah.
But yeah, it was Xena. Again, like complaining about plot points on Xena is even worse than complaining about them on Supernatural. But
I did a rewatch of that several years ago, and I was just like, I feel like this will be my one. One rewatch as an adult. I'm going to do one. It's going to be one. This can be it.
It's
going to be it.
It's like fandom. There's two types of fandoms, and it's very kind of gendered, not totally, but in how it's done. There is like curative fandom, which is like the kind of typical Star Wars fanboy who has all the action figures and has like the serial number of the Millennium Falcon memorized. And that's like they're curating the text. They are celebrating everything about the text as it is and developing this encyclopedic knowledge of the text. And that can be women too, but it's mainly like this, that's sort of the comic book guy from The Simpsons. That's the stereotypical curative fan. And then you have transformative fandom, which is people who say, well, that's a cool idea. I'm going to take this and play with it and change it and inevitably make it gay and probably make it into porn. sorry. But you look at something like one of the big roots of fandom as we know it right now was the Star Trek fandom. And that fandom was completely led by women. And they were writing fanzines about Kirk and Spock that they were sending through the mail in like brown paper and envelopes so you wouldn't know what it was. And so fandom has always been this very queer space and a space where not just queer people, but people who are in any way marginalized can queer or change the narrative and put themselves into it. Because very often these are white, male, nominally straight characters, but fandom is about, or has been until recently, about taking it and making it something that is more representational or intersectional, or at least something that we can take to explore these themes of ourselves in a safe way with characters we know and themes we know.
Absolutely.
That's like a big overview of fandom itself.
And I think that a lot of people, especially as we've gotten older, and especially as we have become more represented on screen, I think we've kind of forgotten the old ways.
The old days were like, I don't know if you were on like fanfiction.net back in the day where you had to like label stuff as like if it was a lemon or a lime was like the slang is like for like a lemon was like kind of rated R and a lime was like rated X. There was a whole like citrus ratings and like
is there like a place like, for a mango? Can I get a pineapple?
I think there was
story?
A grapefruit was something that was just like off the reservation and
I don't. Oh, okay. I don't want a grapefruit story.
No, I don't either. I hate grapefruit. But like, and it's when you have these characters that you know, it's a really kind of this becomes a safe space for people to like explore issues and sometimes very dark things because fan fiction and fandom can get very dark. But it's a safe space. And so, and it's also a way to find yourself in something that wasn't even intended for you. And that's where like the death of the author and like the real classical like Roland Barthes sense comes in where like, we don't care what the author said, we're making everyone gay.
And I don't, I understand that people have a reverence for stuff they love. I have a reverence for stuff that I love. But it doesn't mean that there can't be a different take on it. And I point to things that like, there's always a new Batman in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Like we can't seem to leave Spider-Man alone, but like Peter Pan, how many different versions of we've had the dark and gritty Peter Pan. We've had the animated Peter Pan. We've had multiple animated Peter Pans. We had
the one with hot Jason Isaacs as Captain Hook. That was really good.
And didn't Hugh Jackman, he was...
Oh God, that thing, yeah.
But we've had Hook, which...
Yeah. Oh, I think that movie is great.
I love Hook. And Hook, anybody who says otherwise is wrong.
I had an article about that when it came out on Netflix. I'm like, this movie is great.
It's great. But I mean, those are all very different takes on the original story about, was it Jay and Barry? And I don't think that people realize all of that is just, that's just fandom. That's just somebody saying, well, I want to crack at that character. And the difference between the person writing their little ship, writing their little headcanon online, and Hook is that somebody with a lot of money took somebody's script, somebody's little headcanon, and said, yeah, let's make that a movie. Let's say he grew up and got sad.
Because when you look at it, there are a lot of actual original stories left for humanity. Everything is fanfic in a certain way. Like Dante's Inferno is kind of fanfic of the Aeneid. And he literally is like, it's self-insert fanfic. It's quote unquote Mary's
fanfic of the Bible, but yeah.
Yeah. He makes himself, he has himself meet Virgil. And Virgil's like, Dante, you're like the best writer ever. How could I'm going to guide you personally through like 2/3 of hell or in purgatory. But the Aeneid by Virgil was fanfic, kind of Roman AU fanfic of the Odyssey. Because it was like, okay, let's see what happened on the other side of the Trojan War. And we're going to kind of make it the same as the Odyssey, but it leads to the founding of Rome. And it was Roman propaganda. And so all these things are connected. And, you know, Hamilton is historical fanfic.
Oh, it's very much fan fiction.
Yes.
From the casting to the glossing over certain parts of history to
the queering of it. There's evidence to support that Alexander Hamilton was kind of had something with Lawrence, but we don't know. But that's like one of the great things that the fandom has run with is like, oh yeah, we're going to play with this ship.
And I think that it's important to sort of allow people a space to play a little bit online, to enjoy media in whatever way they want. And if that means that, to them, Harry and Ron are actually end goals. Mm-hmm. And Hermione is just sort of their like best friend who's like, oh, you guys are so cute.
Yeah, because we don't, you know what? Harry Potter no longer belongs to that author.
No. What author?
We've taken custody of that one. The parent is no longer fit. And so, but it's like, there's so much beautiful work in fandom. I've read fanfics and I write fanfic. I haven't written for a few years, but I've written a lot of fanfic. I'm not going to like be shy about that. But I've read fanfics that have left me sobbing, that have been some like the best novels I've read. And you know, that's great. And usually they're like AUs where it's like World War II or whatever. And you just, it's, there's a set of, a sense of security with fanfic that's sort of like romance novels, especially with AO3, Archive of Our Own, which is the main fanfic site where it's all tagged. And so like, if you want to know if your favorite character is going to die, it will tell you. So, you know, going in, there's like a contract. Okay. Everyone's really sad, but there's no major character death tagged. So there's going to be a happy ending. I can make it through this, because sometimes you don't want to get invested in a beautiful book and be like, oh, wait, they are all dead at the end.
So when you're writing about pop culture, mm-hmm. what do you personally find the most interesting parts of pop culture to write about?
I think that like, it's sort of the different ways pop culture is being reclaimed and remixed. And that's a lot of the creators working now came out of fandom and were fans in some ways. You talk to any TV writer and they'll say like, yeah, my first spec script, which is basically like fanfic for TV writers where they write a fanfic script that they submit as like their audition for shows. they'll say like, yeah, it was an X-Files or Star Trek Next Generation script because they were so inspired by those things, or it was Buffy. And so we have so many writers who were coming from that point of view and from marginalized places, and they are now changing things. Like you look at something now like Lovecraft Country, which is a really interesting show where it's taking all these really common horror and sci-fi tropes and recentering them on marginalized people, mainly Black people. And that's so fascinating to me because you're seeing how these stories that were for the most part created by and for white men are being reclaimed and remixed and changed and being more inclusive in the way that so many shows and movies are trying to be more inclusive, sometimes failing a little bit, but at least there's trying now, which I think is better than nothing. And there's also shows that are like making fun a bit of like how ham-fisted some of the attempts at inclusivity are. I'm thinking about like The Boys. It's just fit wrapped up, and it was a super interesting show because it kind of poked direct fun at like Marvel and other, you know, big corporate, you know, IP sort of trying to be like, look at all the girls we have, girls get it done. And so that's sort of the stuff that sort of really digs into it. It's really interesting to me too, as a journalist.
Yeah. But then they also literally kicked the shit out of a Nazi.
Yeah. That was great. So, like, yeah, the girls do get it done. They like, kicked the shit out of Nazis.
I like The Boys.
I love The Boys. It's great. And that's by Eric Kripke, who created Supernatural. And he's like learned and changed a lot, I think, since the first seasons of Supernatural. But you can still see some of the same like fingerprints on it. And
yeah, a lot of the Supernatural shippers are probably pretty excited because Dean is joining the I don't know his name.
Jensen Ackles.
Yeah, whatever. Hot Dean is joining the cast of The Boys next year, and he's playing gay Captain America. So I'm pretty thrilled about that. All right, you're muted.
There we go. Sorry, I was coughing. I muted my mic.
Baby podcaster learning her mute buttons.
I'm so excited because he's such a talented actor. Like even on Supernatural, he is far and away the most talented person in that cast. And I say that with love for Misha and Jared. They're also talented, but Jensen is at like another level. And also he's like so handsome. It's like staring at the sun. I've interviewed him in person a few times, and like the first time it was an experience because I was about a foot away and just like, okay, I'm going to count all the freckles. And yeah. And I say that as a person who identifies as very, very gay.
I was going to say, how does your wife feel about that?
Like I'm pretty gay. My wife is completely another level of gay. Cause uh-huh. I'm like, oh yeah, Jensen Ackles, I would make an exception for that. And she's like, I would maybe let him hold my hand, you know. I mean, I could give him a hug, maybe. Like
give him a hug. Great. I'll give him a hug.
Yeah. We have very funny, it's like my wife and I have very different taste in what we think is like a hot guy. Like she's much more of like a Thor sort of preference. And I don't know if you can see, I've got like Loki behind me. Like Loki is one of my favorite garbage sons is internet calls. But we've decided that Tom Ellis on Lucifer is like the perfect medium between like Tom Hiddleston and Chris Hemsworth. So we both agree that Tom Ellis is pretty cute.
So
that was a tangent. Sorry.
It was quite the tangent. Yes. when you are writing about pop culture, what do you think makes a show successful? What have you noticed about the things that last and the things that don't? Several years ago, and this is going to transition into sort of your Real Magic podcast, but the TV show The Secret Circle, that had all the makings of something that should have lasted a really long time for the CW. It had very hot underwear models. It had a great adult cast. It had a great teen cast, had a good premise. It had a lot of open-ended plot lines that could go a lot of places. And, you know, it didn't take itself so seriously that you couldn't see it becoming like a Scooby-Doo crossover in a future. yeah. this season.
Well, like with the Secret Circle, there's sort of like diegetic and extra diegetic reasons for why it didn't succeed. One of them is that like the person who was running it was like, and this is sort of inside baseball, but was like a complete monster and not a good person to work with. And he hasn't made many shows since then. But like, so the showrunner of that show was not very good at their job. But I think what makes a show really work, and I'll use Supernatural as an example here again, or I can use Lost because it's for the same reason, is when you have really good characters that you can really relate to. And you have, there are human beings that you can see yourself in a lot of ways. And, you know, Supernatural has endured so long because people really enjoy this relationship between these brothers and their Angel. And they're just such compelling people and so human to watch on TV. And that's why Lost worked, is not because of all like the woo-woo with the polar bears, but because they were these flawed, interesting people. And so you can have like all the great plot points you want, but if the characters aren't real and lived in and have somewhere to go, then a show's not going to really work. So I think, I mean, it's pretty simple. It comes down to the characters and finding that really good balance between plot moving forward and having these characters you want to see succeed. Because if it's a character who's an asshole, you're like, okay, fine, let the monster eat you. I'm kind of rooting for the monster now.
You know, I will say I'm kind of glad I can talk to a fandom expert here, because I am a fan of things. I don't know that I'm like a fandom person. I don't know that I belong to a fandom. They tend to scare me, mostly because like...
They are kind of scary.
They're very scary because people get like really hyper protective of the thing that they like. Like white women in their 40s talking about Supernatural and the men on Supernatural talk about it in a kind of way that makes me physically uncomfortable at times. But beyond that, I want to talk about, there are some folks that have come from some of these shows, like Xander on Buffy, and, you know, some of these actors, some of these producers and showrunners and things like that, that have kind of come away and end up being terrible people in real life and, you know, abuse women or are, you know, just terrible, terrible people. But for some reason, the fans are like, no, you're Xander forever. So we love you no matter what, and we'll support you, and you're great, and there's no way you could be a bad person.
That's interesting, because like everyone I know who's like likes Buffy still like just hates Xander. Like that's been a real big movement in a lot of the Buffy critical circles. It's just like Xander really sucked, and Nicholas Brendon, ugh.
All kind of sucked.
And one of the things, you know, I think some of the fandoms that have, you know, really vibrant fandoms right now, where there are really people have conventions and they're really involved in like charity work through the shows, those are the shows mostly who have really good human beings working on them. And one of the things that like made Supernatural successful as like a fandom is the fact that like most of the actors, there's a few exceptions, but most of the actors are like genuinely nice people who really want to like, because they, and they're aware of this power they have for some reason over these crazy girls on the internet. They're like, okay, we're going to do something like with this. We're going to raise money to build an orphanage in Haiti, and we're going to plant trees in Nepal, and we're going to do all this charity work and try and help people. And that sort of makes up for, as you said, the darker side of fandom, because fandom can get really dark. It can be very culty and clicky, and it can be, fandom can definitely be something that can help people through some really dark times in their lives, but also it can be something that keeps them there because they think, oh, I've got fandom. I don't need to move on and grow. And I have, you know, this group of people where I've sort of become a god in fandom, and I can use this to become an abusive person. And it turns into like Supernatural fandom turns into like an episode of The Vow, which I'm also obsessed with, but it can become really dark, and, you know, people can stalk people or dox people, or the amount of death threats I've received on Twitter because I said something mean about Jared Padalecki is kind of crazy. And it's, you know, there's a lot of craziness too. And when you're outside of fandom, it looks extra crazy. You know, when you're in it, you're like the frog in the boiling water. You're like, oh, this is normal. And then you get out, you're like, oh, that was not normal.
This is not normal.
Not normal.
It's not normal. The like you said, the really culty kind of atmosphere created in some of these fandoms. And I don't really, I mean, I know you keep talking about Supernatural, but there are a lot very long running shows whose fans get really culty about the media that they consume.
Yeah. And like, I had a bad experience earlier this year with like the Wynonna Earp fandom. And Wynonna Earp is like, it's a show that's was fine the first season. It's kind of gone off the rails. And I'm sure people, if they listen to this, will get mad at me for saying that. But people hang on to
it. Says the Supernatural fan.
Yeah. But like, at least Supernatural, you can kind of track the plot throughout an episode. Wynonna has a parent, like, But the reason people stick with it is because there are lesbians on it, or a lesbian and a bisexual, and it's a queer couple, and people are so defensive of this couple. And they had this love scene in a recent episode where like it was this beautiful, like soft focus, indies, you know, music playing, sex on the stairs sort of thing. And I'm like, okay, this is, I mean, it's nice to see like a hot love scene on screen, but I wrote about it. I'm like, I'm kind of really tired of seeing cis skinny white women as the only ones who get to have sexy moments on screen. Like, where, why can't we expand that? And it was like, everyone got mad at me because I said, you know, so, you know, sex on the stairs doesn't actually sound, you know, to me personally, doesn't look very comfortable. It was their uncarpeted stairs. Come on, man. And I'm like, but everyone focused on like this joke I made about stair sex and not about the point that I was making about like, I would like to see more inclusivity and representation, even in our queer ships. And this fandom went off on me. And it was like, it was way worse than the Practical Magic thing. And like the showrunner got involved in it. And that was sort of a bad look. But people get very defensive about the things they love. That's sort of where it comes down to. It's almost like politics. It becomes, they will ignore reality in favor of something they love.
Well, and I think the trouble that a lot of people have is they take critique. They take, you know, suggestions as an attack, on them personally, because something they love, you know, a piece of culture that they love means something very, very specific and very personal to them. Like you said, being a part of a fan culture, being a part of a community is being part of a community, whether it's online, whether it's just at conventions a couple times a year, that's community, and that's community for a lot of people. And those kinds of communities, that kind of entertainment, that kind of culture can save people. It can give people a reason to continue going. It can give people a whole career, which is what you've gotten out of it. And so therefore, when anybody critiques it, especially someone that isn't a known quantity inside of the community, it comes across as this horrible, horrible attack. You know, I've sort of experienced it with this show a lot of times. You know, earlier this summer, I said, hey, we don't really have a lot of people of color writing about religions and spiritual paths that are that come specifically from BIPOC communities. And like, you know,
I mean, we should have like actual Black people writing about like voodoo. What?
Yes. And that was a really controversial thing to say, apparently. Yeah. It was a terrible, terrible thing. Go ahead, sorry.
With fandom, like, people identify so strongly with their fandoms, and that is great, but a lot of people fall into it so deeply that their fandom and their fanishness becomes their entire personality, and they identify with it so strongly that when you are critiquing a show or a fandom, they take it as critique of them personally because they are so personally invested in it. And I, you know, I have pissed off a lot of fandoms. I've pissed off the Supernatural fandom a lot because I said, you know, I ship Dean and Castiel. It's never actually going to happen on screen. That's kind of a bummer. But the people who are in these conspiracy theory level commitment to these ships, where they are deconstructing the wallpaper, that it's a secret clue that Dean is actually in love with Castiel, and it's wallpaper behind Dean kissing a woman. I'm like, okay, guys, sometimes wallpaper is just wallpaper. And it's fine to, you know, write fic and ship that ship, but no one's sending you secret messages on the show. And that happened a lot with the Sherlock fandom. It happens a lot. And that gets into the whole queer baiting thing, if we want to talk about that.
I do want to talk about that, because there are a lot of shows, especially like shows that came out in the last 10 years, sort of on the cusp of inclusivity, the cusp of being able to show queer characters at the forefront of a show as the main character, you know, before a Wynonna Earp could become successful.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, and still there's really not a lot of queer identified men in these positions. If you ever find
non-white people,
you know, you're going to find Willow becomes a lesbian. Suddenly she's not bisexual. She's just a lesbian. And all of the relationships she had with men before that, they don't count. They were practice.
But her girlfriend has to die terribly.
Yes, exactly. But that's the thing, is that, you know, we get a lot of, if we get it at all, it's typically women, which is great. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But again, there's just something about Hollywood is just like, but two men kissing. They're going to have to be sidekicks, or they're going to have to be in the background, or it's going to have to be implied. But I feel like in the last 10, 12 years, a lot of folks, you know, played with queer baiting. They would get guys into positions, and there's a lot of locker room scenes, and like the movie The Covenant was like,
I haven't seen it. Was that. Just That's queer gonna bait. Be on here though.
What?
Yeah. I know. I'm really excited to watch it. It's gonna be.
Do you only watch Supernatural? Do you watch anything else? The only thing that she has in her DVR for 15 years is Supernatural and reruns of Supernatural.
I think one of the reasons I never saw The Covenant is one of the reasons it took me 8 years to get into Supernatural, is because I saw The Covenant. I'm like, oh, it's like a boys ripoff of The Craft. And I saw Supernatural and she's like, oh, it's a boys ripoff of like Buffy and Angel and Charmed. And so it took me into like a major depressive episode in 2012 to actually get into Supernatural. But like the queer baiting is such a really, it's an interesting thing to look at from like an academic point of view, because especially in like the years I've been in fandom, the way queer relationships have been portrayed on screen have changed and flourished in a really encouraging way. Like you said, they're still mainly women. There's not as many gay men, and it's still very white, but it's at least, you know, something.
But see, I think that's the problem that I have, is that we get, well, it's something. It's something.
It's something.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it something?
But
is it really something? Or is it just we're going to wink and nod at our gay fans, at our queer fans? We're just going to wink at them. We're going to say, we know you like to see him without his shirt on. and then never really do anything with it.
Well, I think it's like, there's a lot of shows that really kind of changed the game for this. And it's really definitely in the last 5 years. And like there's sort of the queer baity shows where it was like Teen Wolf Merlin or Sherlock, where like in early seasons, they definitely like winked at like, oh, look at these two. They're like paralyzed and on top of each other and people are calling them boyfriends. And then as people were like, oh, are they boyfriends? And then all the shows were like, oh, no, we didn't actually mean to meet. And so that was the real queer baiting, was where they're like, oh, we're just going to pretend here. And we're not actually going to give you anything. But then shows like Shadowhunters, I don't know if you've watched that one. There was a great ship on that show where like you're watching it. At first you're like, is this character kind of in love with this other man? Is that what's going to happen? And they went there fully and it became one of the big romances of the show, was Alec and Magnus. And seeing that on screen was just like really amazing. And it was also a biracial relationship, which I really appreciated. And so like Shadowhunters, I think, is actually a big inflection point, because it was on Freeform of all places, and Freeform has actually become really committed to being as inclusive as it can. And so that kind of changed things. And then you had the Arrowverse has also really been really important in changing this. And the Arrowverse is, you know, pulpy and silly, but it is the whole ship, that whole like verse is commanded by Greg Berlanti, who is an out gay man. And so you have a lot of characters in the Arrowverse that are queer, that are non-white, and it's very much something that they become very committed to. And finally, you have a show like Legends of Tomorrow that has a bisexual woman as a lead, and now you have Batwoman, which has, you know, various lesbians as Batwoman. And so that's like been a big help to kind of change the game in terms of representation. And then you have a show like Supernatural that's been there for this whole run. It's like, okay, you had your queer baby years, and then you kind of moved away from that. And
did they really move away from it?
They kind of no-homoed it pretty hard in recent years. It's like with the whole that, you know, the devil has a son, it's God's grandson, who's going to kill God and all that sort of stuff. And he's sort of become the adopted son of the Winchesters. And that sort of become like, that's Castiel's reason for living, rather than he's totally in love with Dean, which is what most people saw it as.
So I want to talk about real magic.
Okay, yes.
I want to talk about magic on screen. Take a swig, girl. Take a
swig. Yeah, I'm ready.
So I want to talk about magic in media, magic on screen. I'm really curious. I like the premise of your show. And I was someone that in the early days of this podcast, I was very young. I mean, I started this podcast when I was a baby. We're just going to put it that way. I was a baby. And, you know, when you're a baby, you think you have a lot of stuff figured out. You think you know a lot of things. And one of the things that I really just thought that I knew was that pop culture didn't belong in paganism. And that was stupid. That was a stupid thing to think. It was a really dumb thing to think, because pop culture has always been in paganism. I mean, paganism and pop culture has always been a thing together. Taking gods and taking folklore. It's all of it.
Paganism is pop culture.
Yes. And, you know, over the years, I have certainly mellowed and then fallen in love with including pop culture into my paganism. But I'm curious, as the hostess of the Real Magic podcast, what kinds of sources of magic in media, you know, spark that magical interest for you?
I think it's interesting. I have this sort of unified theory of witches and paganism on screen, because usually when a movie's about witches, it's not actually about like real witches or real, you know, magical practices or even Wicca. It's about women and women's relationship to power. And you have several different types of witches you see over and over again. You have the kind of Satan loving ones that get their power from the devil. And so that's saying like, okay, women, you know, who are too sexy or too out there, they are in league with the devil. Then you have witches who are like not human, and their power comes from being inhuman. And then you have kind of a few characters that are like, okay, they're like Sarah or whoever from The Craft, where they sort of adjacent to actual paganism. But what these movies are really about is like, okay, how do we feel about when women are powerful and when they have independence? And, you know, usually witches have been a figure of, you know, fairy tales and folklore, you know, in the Christian era as, you know, evil monsters. And it's been about hating women's power more so than it's been about actually portraying paganism and magic. And so that's one side of it. And then you have the other side where you actually deal with like pagan folklore and gods. And I like that too, but it's always sort of been, you know, comic book fodder. There's not a lot of reverence for those faiths. And one of the portrayals of paganism that always sort of really annoys me is when the pagans themselves are monsters. Like, you know, like a good example is like Midsommar, where it's like, oh, it's so scary. They're pagans. And well, yeah, they're murdering people, but like that whole,
or the Wicker Man.
The Wicker Man. I mean, like, the really scary thing in that remake was Nicolas Cage. And there's always got to be a bear somewhere. But, like, this idea that, you know, pagans and Satanists are really the scariest thing you can encounter is, that's the main thing that bugs me. Any other portrayal of witches, I can, like, find something that, like, okay, well, it's not, like, accurate, but there's really something deeper here about, like, magic and power and even, like, reflections of the divine that you can find. But when, like, the pagans are, like, you're the boogeyman, that's where it really kind of gets under my skin.
Yeah, I think
Midsommar, they were the heroes because they freed her from her shitty boyfriend.
I was, and remain to this day, someone that just doesn't understand our love of the Wicker Man. I don't get it. Is it because they call him pagan? Like, is it? I don't get it. I don't get the love of the Wicker Man. I don't understand, like, our love of something that makes us look like monsters. I don't understand our love of, like, I don't understand it. But I'm also not, like, a big horror fan, so that's probably it.
I'm not a big horror fan either. I'm big old weenie.
I'm not a big horror fan. It's bad. But I do sort of find it interesting, and some of the things that I've had to personally unpack are, you know, we almost all of us, everybody I've ever talked to, you know, I saw The Craft in the 90s. I mm-hmm. saw Practical Magic. I saw Charmed. I saw whatever. And it got me interested in this. And that led me down a path. And then blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. Now I'm a witch 10 years later. And I think it's so interesting how, you know, there tends to be this wave of rebuking pop culture witches after that. It's like, well, those aren't real witches. Oh, don't watch that. That's not real.
Yeah.
And I was certainly one of those people. I was poo-pooing all over it. And I think that it's so weird and so interesting because obviously there was something there that sparked something in you.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way that you sort of celebrate that on the Real Magic podcast. So I want to know, what was the witch that got you interested in witchcraft?
Well, and I can plug the first episode of the Real Magic podcast. For me, it was The Wicked Witch of the West. Mm-hmm. Like, I saw that movie when I was like 2 or 3 years old, and I was obsessed and I wanted to be a witch. And then the next one, the second movie I ever saw was Sleeping Beauty, and I wanted to be Maleficent, which I would run around my house with the cordless phone saying, "And all the powers of hell." And so, and I was always so sad. I'm like, why'd you kill the Dice Dragon? Come on. So that's like, and I don't know if you would consider Maleficent a witch. She's a fairy, but fairies are definitely pagan adjacent. And we're going to have an episode about Disney fairies and how the fae are portrayed in movies and how accurate or inaccurate that is. And
you know, I rewatched it for the first time in a year or so ago. And I forgot that Meriwether is my favorite character in that movie.
She's the best. She's
the best character.
And when, like, it's such an interesting movie from, like, I guess a structural standpoint, because the fairies are really the protagonists of that
yes!
movie. It's not about Sleeping Beauty. It's about the fairies.
I hadn't seen it since I was, probably a kid or barely not a kid. And I had completely forgotten that the movie is basically about the fairies.
Yeah.
It's very little to do with Maleficent. It's almost nothing to do with Sleeping Beauty herself. It is the three fairies. It is Flora, Fauna, and Meriwether. And Meriwether is the best one of all of them. No tea, no shade. She is the best. And I love her.
Yeah. And so, like, I think for a lot of people, those movies that inspire them not to, you know, you're not going to, like I say, like, you're not going to learn any good spells from this, but you're going to learn, like, what it feels to believe in magic.
Mm.
And that's sort of the important thing, is because, you know, movies are just our myths.
Mm-hmm.
Myths are important, and myths are really a big part of paganism. And understanding these things through stories and myths is how we embark on our spiritual journeys. So
I love what you said, that mm-hmm. you're not going to learn, I mean, you're not going to learn actual witchcraft, but you're going to learn what it takes to believe in magic. That is such a beautiful sentiment. Though I will say, I know people and have done it personally that will 100% take the words of a spell that they saw in a Buffy episode or the layout of a ritual that they saw in a movie and be like, I'm doing that. That's the ritual. That's what we're doing. Like, who
100%. When I cast a circle, I use the calling the corners from The Craft. Because
who doesn't want to go out with their friends in a bunch of like black leather and go on the beach and like call the corner and like do the whole craft thing on the beach? Like, who doesn't want to do that? That's fun. That sounds fun. Looks fun.
Yeah. And it's like The Craft was such like a gateway for so many people to paganism. And that movie has like a lot of problems, but it's also just like it showed you the witches is like the protagonists, and it was a fun movie. It's still entertaining, and like, you know, we can forgive a lot of things if they're entertaining. Like, the worst offenders are when it's like bad portrayal of witchcraft, and it's also like a stupid, boring movie. Like, I don't know if you saw like Beautiful Creatures. Do you remember this thing with like Emmy Rossum or whatever? Mm-hmm.
We did that for a book club years ago.
Oh my gosh.
And we read the book first and then we watched the movie. And my husband loved the movie.
Aww.
And every single person in book club was like, well,
that was something we just watched.
That's a thing we just watched. That's bad. That's so bad. I will tell you, the book is only barely better, but it's still a little better. It's not great.
Yeah, it's also one of those movies that, like, you know, like Aragon or other things, or where it was supposed to have a sequel. Like, oh, this is going to start this whole franchise.
Yeah.
And somebody's like, nope, we're just going to leave it on that giant cliffhanger.
It's bad. And Emmy Rossum deserves better. And she's gotten a better career since, but it's like Emmy Rossum deserves better.
I won't go into why I hate her, but
I'm guessing it's because of the 17 Phantom of the Opera posters that I see behind you.
It might be because like that movie was very bad. I'm still mad at that movie.
Mm-hmm. And that was totally her fault specifically.
Like, well, I mean, that movie. I mean, I just wish they'd hired people who could like sing for a movie with the word opera in the
shade.
Title.
Oh, shade. Oh, wow. Oh, the shade. So what is, You talk about magic and specifically paganism in, you know, reflected in film and television. What is to you the most realistic portrayal of magic, witchcraft, paganism in TV and media?
That's like so hard because there's just not a lot of realistic portrayals of it. I mean, it's hard because I'm also an attorney, as I mentioned, and it's like saying like, what's the most realistic portrayal of a lawyer on screen? And there aren't many of those either. Like, I think, you know, the legal profession is portrayed just about as accurately as paganism. And I have a lot bigger, much harder time watching legal shows than I do watching pagan shows.
I can't watch, because of what we talked about earlier, I was a police officer and, specifically in juvenile services, and I can't watch like crime scene investigation shows because like you don't want to hear me go off on my tangent about like tire tread and how long it actually takes to get like a tire tread sample analyzed to tell you what tire was used in the making of that tire tread. Like, it's like it takes months.
Yeah. With most like cop and legal shows, it's just time doesn't work that way.
No.
Like, people come into like the lawyer's office in the morning and then they're in trial in the afternoon. I'm like, no, that would take 3 years to trial.
Yeah, no.
And it's just not that exciting. I think like I would, you know, we're going to talk about this on Real Magic, but like, I think practical magic in a lot of senses is sort of accurate to like the feeling of witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I can't, as many times as I tried when I was 13, I can't light a candle by blowing on it, but it's kind of got that feel of just like magic being inherent in the world. So I would say that's like a pretty good portrayal of witchcraft. I mean, The Craft is close. I mean, they made up a whole god, but I mean, at least it's, you know, it speaks to everyone's, you know, a lot of our teen experiences of just like, I'm going to find friends and we're going to start a coven. But
yeah, so I need you to go to the Hallmark channel, and I need you to watch The Good Witch on Hallmark.
I've been trying to watch that. That's like on my list.
Okay, go watch all the movies first and then watch the TV show. It's worth it. Like I feel like you'll enjoy it. Mm-hmm. That is the most realistic portrayal of magical television.
And like there, you know, there's a lot of like historical shows that show, you know, paganism sort of just as the religion. Like if you look at like Spartacus or Rome, you see kind of some interesting portrayals of like Roman religion. And
I feel like the one that so many people wanted to be true, that also gets into some of the things that we were talking about earlier about problematic creators or problematic people, The Mists of Avalon.
Oh boy. Oh yeah. Talk about problematic creators. I like that. That was like, you know, a real heartbreak finding that. Yeah. Cause like that was one of the books, you know, was like, it was so formative for so many, like just millions.
Well, and the miniseries, what was it? The TBS miniseries. Oh,
TNT,
my God.
Oh, that was like, yeah. That made it a bit easier to kind of turn.
I mean, it was beautiful and you wanted to live on Avalon.
I did. I just want Angelica Houston to, like, Angelica Houston is sort of like, the
witch for you. Is she the grand high witch?
Well, because she's like been in so many witchy things. She's been in The Witches and Addams Family and Mists of Avalon. She's just one of those people who's, or her and Fairuza Balk have just been in everything. But like
they should do a movie together.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, funny, like I think one of the best portrayals accurately of a god we've seen is this, like, I love Loki in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because I think that's actually very true to the actual like spirit of Loki in the myths, because he's, you know, he can be good or bad.
He's an alien and not a god.
yeah, that's true. But he's Tom Hiddleston, so it's out to accept a lot of things because of that. But yeah, like the way that...
So like, not the witch that got you into witchcraft. Who is your favorite witch in media right now?
My favorite witch, like, in media right now, like, that's currently airing.
I mean, like, let's say, like, last 10 years or so.
Like, I mean, I'd like, you know, not to be a dead horse.
Is it Supernatural? Like, is it the Supernatural?
No, I love Rowena, because I don't know if you've met her, because she didn't show up until season 10. But, you know.
No, I didn't make it to season 10.
She's the King of Hell's mom, you know, normal. Mm-hmm. But she's just so much fun, because, like, all the best witches have red hair. Because if you make all my favorite witches have red hair, you've got Winifred from Hocus Pocus, who would probably be my favorite if you weren't limiting it to last 10 years. Because she's just, it's Bette Midler. She's having the time of her life. I got myself a Winifred dress for Halloween. I'm very excited about that.
To have Halloween in your living room?
Yeah, whatever. Just like, or just to wear around the grocery store. Like, why not? But like, I really like Rowena because she is just a woman who wants what she wants and does what she wants, and she ends up, for most of the series, she's unkillable, and she's just sort of fabulous and Scottish, and the actress who plays her is just a dear, wonderful person who's become a friend, and I just love Rowena a lot because she's just fabulous, and she tries to start a mega coven and it's just complete failure, and she always is trying and to get more power and not quite getting it, but yeah, not an accurate portrayal of anything, but very fun. I also love The Magicians. That's one of my favorite shows of recent
love
years.
Grossman. The trilogy of books is great. The show is great. They're both great for very, very different, reasons.
Yeah.
The show has become absolutely nothing whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Like the books. It was kissed on the cheek. It kissed the books on the cheek and then ran off and did its own thing.
Which, like, and I think that's sometimes a good way to adapt something is to sort of just go in your own way. I love so many of the female characters on that show. I love Julia, and because she's been on such an interesting journey from like trauma to empowerment to, you know, finding her happiness.
I'm glad they departed from the books in that, because she wouldn't have shown back up again until just the very, very, very end of whatever the very last season was. And she wouldn't have ever spoken.
Yeah. And like, I loved Elliot and I loved Alice. I just loved that show. I was really kind of sad to see it.
Never mind. It was Alice. Was the one who wouldn't have shown up until the very end.
Yeah. So like, those are some of my recent favorites. And have there been any like good witch? I mean, we're getting two new witch movies this month, but they're like, you know, I'm trying to think of good witch movies that we've gotten in the last few years. I'm kind of coming up. Because like the last few years, witches on movies have been like, what if all the things they accused witches of during the witch trials were actually true? And what if, you know, they did?
Oh, you mean Salem?
Yeah.
The TV show Salem?
I have that one that I've not seen because I just saw the premise. I'm like, oh boy, no.
Oh my goodness. Okay. I'm going to work through all these things. Editor at the Mary Sue and say, until she starts watching more things than Supernatural, she is banned. Go watch Salem. It's good. It's a solid show.
This is one of the, like, to kind of go back to like being a journalist, this is one of the hardest things about being a journalist right now in peak TV, because there are so much television right now. It's kind of ebbed because of the pandemic, but I can spend, you know.
There was that one that came out earlier this spring that I still haven't watched. Was it Homeland?
Motherland, Fort Salem.
Motherland, that.
That was that one's weird. And
Yeah, that's one where I saw the preview and I was like,
It's got a really interesting premise. Like, what if one witches actually had like magical powers and they use their voices to like do all sorts of things, which is an interesting, conceit. And like, you can bind a witch by like binding her vocal cords.
I like that.
But it's like, they're kind of their dynamic that they're building towards between like involving Christianity, something that I'm a bit leery of, because like the hero witch has like special powers because she taps into like Christian gospel. I'm like, okay. And they're kind of making fun of all like the witches who are like into the goddess, because they do talk about like the goddess, and they have a Beltane episode that all the witches get their power from having sex with men. That's how they, you know, power up. Like, the men only function as like their batteries, which is an interesting choice. So I'm like, I don't know how to feel about that show, but there is a queer relationship at the center of it as well, so that's nice. But inevitably one of the lesbians is evil, so that's another thing.
Miss Jess Mason, I like nothing more than talking about witches in media all day. Where can folks find you? You are the hostess of the Real Magic Podcast.
Yeah, and we're on Twitter at Real Magic Pod, and that's across all social media. And I'm also on Twitter myself as Fangirling Jess. And then I write about everything over on the Mary Sue. I write about the news. I write about witchcraft. I write about television. I'm just sort of a
Jill of all trades. You write about how the ants and practical magic are secretly gay.
Yeah, yeah.
Just destroying.
I've just broken practical magic. If you want to find out where I write fan fiction, just ask me on Twitter and I'll give you my fan fiction handle, because, you know, I'm pretty proud of some of that Destiel fan fiction I wrote back in the day. It's still pretty good.
Well, Miss Jess Mason, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, of course. Of course. If you guys would like to get more of Jess, everything is going to be in the show notes at incitingariot.com. And don't miss, because I'm going to be on Miss Jess Mason's show real soon. At some point.
I think it'll be next Friday.
Yay!
The 20 whatever third.
The weird way that time works out here is this episode is actually going to come out on Election Day here in the United States. So fun. The show that you and I record is going to come out before this show.
We'll go back in time and listen to that too. And since it's Election Day, have some more wine and
It's
going to be okay.
Fine. I'm trying really hard, just cognitive dissonance, lots of just alcohol and coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. Fun. Thank you so much, Jess.
Thank you.
Well, rioters, that's gonna do it here for inciting a real magic riot. I want to thank my guest, Jess Mason. You can find all of her information in the show notes on my website at incitingariot.com. I hope that this was a little respite from the anxiety spiral that I know a lot of you guys are in right now. I am right there in it with you. I just came back from the grocery store buying extra bottles of wine and cookies and trying to figure out whether or not putting myself into some kind of like alcohol-induced coma is the healthiest coping mechanism, or whether or not
I should maybe just try to tough it out. We're going to see which one of those wins later today, probably depending on folks in Florida and Pennsylvania, unfortunately. Just trusting people in Florida and the exurbs of Philadelphia to decide whether or not I'm a human. So anyways, if you like the show and you want to help us out, you can give as little as $1 a month to further independent pagan media in patreon.com. I'm so sorry, my dog just like jumped on me. My giant dog, Eggsy, has decided that his coping mechanism today is me, which is very sweet, but he is under the impression that I am fine. I am not. Anyways, so if you like the show, you can support it at patreon.com/incitingprojects. You can also like the show on Facebook, facebook.com/incitingariotpodcast. I'm at Inciting a Riot on most other social medias, at Inciting a Riot on Twitter, on Instagram. I don't tick or talk yet. I don't snap or chat. I don't do any of those things, though I will say you guys are kind of winning me over to the TikTok. Maybe I'll tick or talk or something. I don't know. I will say, I am not really sure if another show comes out before this happens, but I did want to let you guys know. Yes, it does. Okay, good. So this is the last show that will come out before November 15th, because the next episode isn't scheduled until November 17th. So on November 15th, I am doing a really, really, really cool thing. I am going to be doing an online concert thing. That's literally what it's called. It's an online concert thing with SJ Tucker. Oh my gosh, what is my freaking life, man? I am doing an online concert thing with SJ Tucker on November 15th at 2:00 Central Standard Time. You can find details for that on Facebook. On my Facebook Inciting a Riot page, there is an event there called Online Concert Thing with SJ Tucker. There is a link. Tickets are pay what you want, pay what you think are, but the minimum ticket price is $8. So you're welcome to pay more than that, but it is $8 a ticket. The website is onlineconcertthing.com, but a direct link to the actual event is on Facebook. Both my page and SJ Tucker's page have it. Hundreds of people have already said that they're coming, and that's crazy. Do not worry, I am not singing. SJ is singing, and I will be reading some poetry from my new book, While I Wait to Be a God Again, which came out earlier this year. And any and all press that I had planned for it was truncated because yay pandemic. So by the way, I wrote a book. It's called While I Wait to Be a God Again. It's another collection of poems about God's magic, growing up gay, and what happens after we die. It's gotten some pretty cool reviews, so that's neat. If you have any interest at all in supporting me, I do have signed copies of the book on my Etsy page, or you can find it on Amazon or wherever fine books are sold. I'm going to stop talking now. I'm going to stop. I'm done. Y'all need to go get your bottles of wine. You need to go find your fuzzy blankets, settle in for the evening, try to find a distraction. I hope this was one, but find another one. It's okay. It's totally fine. I love you guys. Take care of yourselves. I'm going to leave you, but as always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.